Okay, we might kick off because we've got a pretty tight timetable for this session today. So we're meant to start at 11:55, and so we're pretty much on that route now, and most of the people probably are here already. My name's Andrew Boyle. I'm the convener of the Superannuation Practice Committee. I'm also a member of the Superannuation Risk Management and Financial Condition Report Task Force that was started in late 2010. The main role of the task force is to really improve the approach of the Institute around risk management in superannuation and to promote actuaries as thought leaders in this area and to provide support for actuaries doing work in this area. We were very grateful for Darren Wickham, who's a part of the task force, and also Jules Gribble, who's another presenter today. I'm not going to introduce them at length today because they know who they are, but they're part of the task force. But Darren got the first draft of the slides out about 11 o'clock on Friday night, because what happened on Friday was APRA released the standards. And so we thought that given that's the topic of the day, we might actually have to talk about what was in the standards. And there's quite a bit in it, but I think on the whole the standards are in pretty good shape. There's a number of things that we can talk about today about things that we want to add to them or change, but so we're looking for feedback from you today or some questions around about the feedback we want to put through in a submission that's due later. But without taking up any more time, I'll hand over to Darren because we're on a tight schedule with all of these standards that came out.
So thanks, Andrew. Yes, we're grateful for APRA for releasing the standards on Friday. We're a bit nervous. We had a plan B, which was a karaoke singing competition if we didn't have standards, so you should all be very relieved. Now, there was about 11 standards that were issued on Friday. We're not going to go through all of them. We're going to go through the ones that we think are relevant, particularly relevant for actuaries or where there's something of particular interest. And the main ones are risk management. You can see them there. And at the end, we want to talk a little bit about how we think financial condition reports for super tie in very nicely with these standards. So just an overview before we kick off. The standards were released on Friday, and there's going to be a consultation on the draft, so we are keen to get your input, either at this session or afterwards, if you can contact Andrew or myself. And I should say, as we go through each of these different sections, feel free to make comments on the particular topic, and then we'll move on.
We'll use the microphone for that, because we want those recorded as well, so just put your hand up and I'll come to you quickly.
So APRA intend to finalise the standards at the end of 2012, and they're currently beginning work on the draft prudential guides. So these are the practice guides which will flesh out the standards. The standards themselves are actually quite brief and quite readable, actually. So there's this accompanying practice guides which we think will be very important. In the next couple of months, we are going to also see a package released on the MySuper authorisation and the data collection, which is all about the funds reporting. And at the end of all of that, APRA will commence their MySuper authorisation from 1 January 2013, start accepting the applications. It's quite interesting going through the standards. It does seem to be that APRA have tried to have consistency across the different industries with life and GI, the recent LAGIC changes, and you can see that, and we think that's welcome. So I'll turn to the risk management standard first, and I'm not going to go into every detail of the risk management standard. I'm really focusing on what is significant and what is different. But interestingly, APRA have defined risk management framework quite broadly. And importantly, it includes a risk appetite statement as well as a risk management strategy. And we'll talk a little bit about the risk management, the risk appetite statement on the next slide. So like currently, there's a written business plan that's required. As foreshadowed, there is a designated risk management function or role. Now, they've used the word designated instead of dedicated, and that's quite important because initially it was going to be a dedicated role that couldn't be mixed with other roles. So now it is possible to have a shared role for this function, but they do have to be operationally independent. So the framework also consists of very defined roles within the organisation, the policies and procedures, and a comprehensive review process, at least every 3 years, but also a requirement for a yearly review process as well, and a compliance audit. So all of that is backed up by adequate human, financial and technical resources, which is a requirement. But it's interesting, the framework is considered to be all of these things, and I think that's consistent with how the life and general standards are framed. Now, one thing that is slightly different is risk appetite. And previously, funds needed to have some comments about risk appetite in the risk management frameworks. And in Life and GI, there is a requirement to have an articulated risk appetite. But what they've done that's quite different in this standard compared to the other LAGIC changes is the need for a dedicated single risk appetite statement by the board. So that is designed to cover each category of material risks as well as the whole fund. And it requires the board to articulate the degree of risk that they're prepared to take, except on a fund level, but also for each risk category, the maximum level of risk tolerance. And certainly we think that that needs to be formulated based on some numerical modelling and stress testing. And they've said very clearly that it needs to be measurable and quantifiable. So this is moving away from the sort of the motherhood statement about risk appetite to some hard numbers. So there needs to be a process for setting that risk appetite, which involves estimation of the impact and modelling about the likelihood of the risk itself. So this is something that is quite a step from where we currently are. It involves a significant amount of additional work, we think, and certainly I think from the Life and General people, we'll probably get some feedback on how significant that actually is. For those that are interested, there was a very good speech by Ian Laughlin last year talking about the Life and General approach to risk appetite, where he articulated APRA's views on the things that boards should consider and how they will be reviewed in terms of their risk appetite. And the Risk Management Practice Committee has a subgroup which is working on helping actuaries articulate risk appetite. So I think we'll join up with them shortly. So some other things. There will be an annual APRA declaration about the risk management framework and notification of breaches within a certain period, which is not too far away from where we are now. There are rules for treatments of groups. You can rely on, if you're a retail fund and you're the part of a broader financial services company, you can rely on that broader risk management group, but the board has to articulate that it's appropriate and that there's enough resources given to the fund's risk management function, and similarly adequacy of resources. So any comments, questions, or
David Knox. The whole concept of risk appetite for a superannuation plan or pension plan, particularly an accumulation plan, is really interesting. Yeah. I've got two questions. One, do we know whether it's been done anywhere else in the world? Have any other regulator asked that? In other words, are we following or are we leading? And two, could you explain a little bit more about the risk management group that you're going to link to and what you expect coming out of that?
Personally, I'm not aware of other accumulation requirements for accumulation funds around the world to do this. Is anyone else? Any? No. But certainly, I mean, this is something that the life and general and banking sectors have been working on for a little while. Although it's interesting, Ian Laughlin's paper last year said that there was a variety of practice in the insurance industries, and that there was no single spot for necessarily the articulation of risk appetite. So they've really focused here. The Risk Management Practice Committee does have a group. Jacqueline Reed, who's at Marsh, is one of the people that's on that group. And I understand, I don't know much about the workings of that group, but I think they're due to produce something for actuaries later this year. So. Any other comments? Has anyone got experience in doing this? I understand one fund, or close to one fund, that's done this, and it's been quite a difficult exercise for the board in trying to come to grips with what's appropriate and how to articulate it. Okay.
Jules? I got told to come over. I wasn't trying to make him go away. I get to talk a little bit about the off-risk stuff, the requirements. Just want to make a couple of observations beforehand. This is the only place, as far as I can in reading these things, where there's a direct link to holding capital or reserves. However, you need to recognise that off-risk incorporates most of the other things that are covered in these other standards. So it's not that this is the only place where there's capital. This is the place where all the capital and reserves get collected up into one spot. Second observation is that there's a very clear, in operational risk, there's a very clear link back to the overall risk management framework. So this is always in the context of working within that broader ambit of risk management all the way through. So the link back to the board is very strong. It's a strong explicit role for the boards of the RSE licensees throughout all these standards. And one of the things that's quite noticeable, I think, is that role has been made much more explicit than it used to be. And the last thing is, these are very principles-based approaches. In APRA's normal style, they are deliberately not prescriptive, so don't ask them to do the prescribing because I don't think it'll work. However, when the practice guides come out, they will contain more detail and more insight. In the short run, if you want to get some more insight into how APRA is thinking, not promising, read the document that is the one that reports on comments on submissions to the discussion paper. That has some interesting statements in it, so you can all download that from the site. So in the terms of op-risk, right, what's happening first? First up, the trustee determines their own target. In the prior work, there was this debate about 25 basis points minimum and that's on. That's gone. All right? This is, you will determine your own target in the context of your fund, in the context of the risks that you believe that you face. This puts a lot of onus back on the funds to do it and get it right. Or, yes, actually, to get it right, reasonable. The second thing, and this, I think we think this is a good thing, is the op-risk reserve / capital, leave that distinction aside. It actually consists of two quite distinct components. The first component is what they talk about is known risks. These are the risks that you as the fund have identified in your risk management framework, so you've listed them off and you hold capital around those. The second layer of the risk is the ones you didn't know about. Okay, so that when a new op risk comes along, you can't go, oh, we can't use our op risk reserve because it's new and we didn't know about it. So we're looking here, we're thinking, here's materiality and judgment and useful input for actuaries. So there's two tranches to the op-risk reserve that you hold. Second component is, in that, leaving aside the sources of the money, we now have the idea of what's called an ORFR, Operational Risk Financial Requirement, read reserve. And you set a target for that. That's where you're going and that's what you plan toward getting. Below that, you have what's called a tolerance limit. And it's only when you fall below that tolerance limit that you need to really start putting in place the replacement process, replenishment process. So it's a bit of noise that you can have before the trigger gets pulled. But I think it's also clear to say, make no mistake, that the place where APRA is focusing is on not the tolerance limit, but the full reserve. Okay, so it's a two-tiered process with a trigger. And if you fall below the threshold, we have the usual sort of stuff. Do something, and you've got to tell the troops within 10 business days. The 10 business days is a pretty standard thing all the way through here. Recognise that the process that takes place for all of these standards, but this one in particular, is that the entity does the work and produces its best estimate, whatever they want to call it. APRA always retain the right to review that and, what would be a good euphemism, Romani, adjust it, which is a bit like, we've looked, we don't like it, the answer now is whatever it turns out to be. So there's a dynamic that sits in here that once you've done the work, APRA will give it a review and it may move. So it behoves everybody to do this properly and document it well first up, otherwise you tick off the referee. Probably not a good idea. There is some treatment of conglomerates and groups, which Darren's already mentioned. Basically, it comes down to you can use the group thing, provided that the board explicitly signs off that it's okay, and it's in the interest and satisfies the requirements of the RSE licence. Okay, so the primacy of the board and the primacy of the licence are there. Capital or reserves is called reserves if it's held within the fund. It's called capital if it's held by the RSE licensee. Basically, the game rule is that you have to have unfettered access to the money, whether it's held at the licensee or not. Sort of fairly obvious, if you like. So the common tier capital. You have to produce an operational risk strategy document. So it's a separate document for the ones that comes underneath the risk management stuff. It's a bit like OpRisk is a microcosm of the whole risk management framework. The exercise, if you have the unfortunate pleasure of having an OpRisk event, you have to go into replenishment, fill the piggy bank up, have to replenish over a reasonable period. And this is it's actually not defined, and it's reflecting equity in the members and all those stuff. I suspect if you went more than 3 years, you would raise eyebrows, but you might get out to 5, potentially, depending on exactly what it is. But 3 years, I suspect, is going to be the unwritten rule. You must have a plan. Okay, that's before the event happens, not afterwards. And it's got to tell you what happened, how you're going to do it, and when you're going to meet it. So, real plan. This plan, if I recall correctly, has to be approved by the board, in principle, at least before things happen. So there's a certain amount of pre-planning that comes into play. Note the last piece, the referee gets a vote. A few other things that are sitting in here. Got to review the target and the tolerance annually, so it's not set and forget. Internal and external audit have to be done for both adequacy and effectiveness. We might want to argue about exactly what the word audit means at a later date. The referee gets a vote. And notifications if emerging risks require material amounts of money or something's happened that's material. So the word material gets there quite a lot. It's undefined. So, again, this is the scope and judgment coming into play here. And what else have we got here? 3-year transition from the 1st of July 2013. Everything starts the 1st of July 2013. 13's a lucky number. There's a requirement for a notification transition plan, 10 days notice if you don't get things right, and the APRA review on defined benefit plans is they still require, or they will be viewed as part of the overall plan, and the argument that we have a covenant with the employer that's very strong is not good enough because it's not legally binding. In other words, DB plans come under the OpRisk umbrella and by implication quite likely not at zero. How am I going? Other issues for final governance? Yeah, there's a few other things. These are issues that are mentioned in that comments document that I mentioned beforehand. So there's a number of things where there's further guidance promised. I think I'm done. One more slide. I'm entranced.
I think there's one more slide.
Is there one more slide?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, it's not.
No, go back.
Go back. Didn't say that.
You rushed through the last two.
Well, this is homework.
That gives you a chance for a couple of questions. Ramani, you had something before, a comment you wanted to make?
Yeah, just probably combine with this segment. I think one helpful way of looking at all of this is, as Jules pointed out, there is an element of convergence between different industries which are being regulated by APRA. If you look at that, target capital regime in life insurance, where there is a capital adequacy, and APRA often comes and says, and same thing with banks, if that's the minimum capital you must hold, what kind of cushion do you have? What's your cushion? So in the same sense, any reserve or war, FR, or whatever acronym they choose to call it, they would from time to time expect the reserve to fall. Therefore, there would be an iterative process. In accepting a level of reserve, you can expect that they would say, if that's the reserve you want, please have a little bit of cushion so that you can fall below it and we still have some time to work with you. That's point one. These are my thoughts. The second one is that it is possible to argue for entities that the target we are talking about is to cover the residual risk to which the entity is exposed. Not the gross risk, but the gross risk as adjusted by any risk mitigant. Obviously, if you are an APRA, you will say, okay, we will also adjust it for any risk enhancer. If there is anything else which enhances the risk, like if you have got overseas investments or if you have got overseas parents whom we cannot access, then we will consider it a risk enhancer. So we will make a plus or minus adjustment. The other thing about the 3 to 5 years, something which intrigues me is about 3-5 years, but you have to do these things on an annual basis. I think that would give the regulator to watch the market. If there is a particular risk which is blooming up, then they might say, you might normally get 3 years, but in this particular context, valuation risk is too high, therefore we will not allow you 3 years, we will allow you less. These are some of the thoughts. I mean, all of these need to be tested. As Jules says, the prudent practice guides is an extremely important point of view, input. And in providing input to the standards, I think the institute's task force as well as individual entity would be better off providing some input to the prudential practice guide. Prudential practice guide is how the standards will actually be implemented. APRA's interpretation of what the standards mean. If you think that the prudential practice guide is taking an extremely rigid or aggressive or overly impractical view, I think we have an obligation to say that before the PPGs are finalized.
Yeah, I think there is an element here that we're at the end of the beginning, not the beginning of the end.
Hand back to Darren. Oh, yeah. Now for a couple, two more slides.
Just briefly on investment governance. The standard is not about investment management. It's explicitly about governance of investments. There's the whole CIS Act has got lots of things about what you can and can't do about investment management. This talks about links to the risk management framework. It talks about diversification and does talk about some risk and return measures. There was some clarification that this applies to both the choice and my super. There was some uncertainty about that. But there was a previously a requirement to discuss an investment philosophy. That's gone. But what was not foreshadowed and was quite a surprise in the standards was, and is not actually discussed in the APRA discussion paper, is the need for stress testing. When formulating an investment strategy, the trustee will need to determine stress scenarios that can create losses or make risk control difficult, and to undertake stress testing before the strategy is implemented. So this is quite a change. And similarly, when regularly monitoring, there needs to be a program of regular stress testing, and that stress testing needs to be aligned to the risk management framework. And it's actually a requirement that the stress tests are reviewed by senior management and the board.
Can I just add a couple of things to that slide? There's go back to it. There's just a couple of things that I picked up in those areas too, was that the board itself must have sufficient understanding of all the investments. So all of this stress testing, it's not, you know, that can't, the understanding can't be delegated. The board itself must have full understanding of all the investments, and the monitoring needs to be done by someone independent of the investments themselves. So someone implementing the investments can't be doing the monitoring.
So that feeds into liquidity. There's extra requirements now on managing liquidity. The boards need to have a liquidity management plan for each investment option, not just for the whole fund, but for each investment option. And once again, to consider a range of stress scenarios, and importantly, to define a threshold that constitutes a liquidity event. And once that liquidity event occurs, the trustee needs to define in advance what the action it's going to take, and that also means notifying APRA. So that's a little bit of a change. These things weren't actually anticipated prior in the prior discussion.
Yep. Question on the stress testing. I'm presuming that applies to current investment strategies as well, not just new ones.
That's a very good point.
I don't know.
The part of the MySuper authorisation will require revised documentation of the policies and plans. So transition hasn't been covered. That's a good point to raise.
But it's certainly part of the monitoring. You'd expect that if it's not done immediately on the transition date of 1 July 13, that you would need to do it pretty quickly as part of the monitoring process anyway. So one way or another, it'll be done within 12 months.
Do you envisage that that's going to be required in all the choice options?
That's right,
yes.
The whole fund.
Every investment that is made needs to be follow these procedures. Yeah, I mean, if you're looking at some of those things, Emma, and liquidity is one of those things that you mentioned there, wasn't it, Darren, about the liquidity management plan. And one of the things that Darren's group, a couple of years ago, did was a survey of industry super funds around their risks they faced, and the lowest risk that they were facing, they thought, was liquidity. I think APRA is demonstrating their understanding that that's one of the higher risks they think is actually out there, and so they've actually focused a lot of effort on liquidity. We'll spend some time now on defined benefit matters. As you can see, there's a lot to get through on all of these areas. I'm not going to go through each of those points one by one, so I'll put them all up to start with so you can sort of have those in the background to look at while I'm talking. But the main things to come out of this is that there's going to be what's called a shortfall limit that is specified. That's going to be based on vested benefits. So when there is a shortfall as measured against vested benefits, then that's something that needs to be addressed. What has to happen in that situation is that if you don't expect that that will naturally address itself within 1 year, then you have to take some action. Now, one of those things is you have to do an interim valuation to assess what you need to do. One of the comments I've got there, though, around here is this point here, the 12 months or the next valuation, if sooner. So you can actually set a threshold that says, you know, do you expect a 2% might be recovered by markets or something over the next 12 months. The trouble with this last little add-on about or the next valuation, if it's sooner, is a dynamic thing, that at one point or other, the next valuation is due in 7 months' time. Then it's 6 months, then it's 5 months, then it's 1 day. So what happens when the next valuation is due tomorrow? Can you have the same threshold that applied when you've got a full year to run? So I expect, I mean, just preempting our response already, is that that part doesn't make any practical sense, and that being able to rectify itself within 12 months is probably about the limit you can go to in this sort of area. But that's something just for you to think about behind the scenes and put some contributions forward for us to put forward in our submission. They also define now regular valuations. Regular valuations are annual if you've got less than five members. They're triennial for most other situations. If you've got DB pensions, they're also annual unless APRA gives you the opportunity to go out to somewhere greater than 12 months but less than a regular 3 years. A very important area is in section 15 of this standard, which is about being able to APRA can direct the licensee to appoint an actuary. So APRA can request the trustee to conduct evaluation, an interim evaluation or evaluation, and they can direct the trustee to appoint, use their current actuary or another actuary. So if they're not, for some whatever reason, they choose, they want to have a different actuary appointed, then they have that power to say, no, I don't want that actuary, I want another one. And so we need to understand what issues, what areas that might come into play. That is consistent with standards that operate, I think, in the other areas. And from speaking with people last night, it's an area that hasn't been implemented so far in insurance. So, but it's an option that they always retain. So I wouldn't get too caught up about it. We just need to have some understanding about it, that's all. And what issues might drive that direction. The six-month time frame for regular valuation. So the valuations will be required to have the final report issued within 6 months of the valuation date. Does anybody in the room have any concerns about that? Does everybody in the room, given every single one of their valuations over the last 20 years, have been out within 6 months of the valuation date? And have you got the data from the administrator within 6 months of the valuation date in some cases? So that's obviously something we will like input on about a practical experience and the practical outworkings of that. I think it's genuinely a good thing to be striving for, and I think it's something that's probably achievable, but we just need to make some changes to make sure that we get that under control. APRA can request a new report if it's in the member's best interests, and likewise, which actuary does that. One of the other things that's in there as well is that in the current professional standards, we talk about doing projections to make sure that the fund will remain solvent on your assumptions over the next 3 years. That's actually now in the standard, that you must do a projection under the standard for at least covering at least 3 years. Yes. Yes. So that has to be kept aside for other purposes, so it can't be used for the shortfall limit against vested benefits.
So the multi-employer
funds,
normally that's one reserve, which is, you
know,
you wouldn't actually call
the
separate reserve for a
fund, meaning
being
fund. You are entitled to hold
sub-reserves,
so yes, you can allocate it out.
So you're entitled to that. Are we expected, does this expect us to actually hold a separate reserve for a fund,
haven't seen anything that gives that expectation.
There's guidance to come on that. It's in those comments things that you can hold sub funds, you know, under APRA will provide further guidance, so it's not clear.
Yeah, but I think the situation, though, is that this does apply to sub funds, but if you've got the ORFR at a sub fund level or at the whole fund level, doesn't matter, all of those are excluded. So when you're actually determining the shortfall, you just exclude that wherever they're held. It's only the assets that are available to meet the benefits and not set aside for risk that you can use to measure against the shortfall limit.
My suspicion is that there's going to be at least a PPG, if not a standard on sub-funds. Right. There has been a lot of concern about how sub-funds are being seen by members as their own fund, but there's a lot of contamination with other funds of which they are a part. Therefore, it's more than likely that APRA might say, at least in a PPD, is not a standard, that if you have a sub-fund, these are your requirements.
Yep.
I mean, that's not something that you need to
yep. Yes?
So just a quick one. Is there anything about how the slot management grants ORFI yes. should actually be held as in discrete assets, separate assets?
Yes, you have to define a separate investment strategy for it.
Yep.
Just one question. In the event of the fund more than that,
yep. Well, there's a requirement when you set up the ORFR strategy, whatever it is. One of the things is, what do you do on wind up? So you've got to explicitly set it up, plan it out at the beginning before the wind up happens.
But you've got your governing rules to comply with first and foremost. That if you're if it goes to members, it goes to members. So quickly on some of the issues that come out on this slide is. If the fund becomes unsatisfactory or is about to become unsatisfactory, don't know whatever time frame, but if it's about to become unsatisfactory, you must prepare a statement within 15 business days. And it's within 15 business days of making that finding. So be very careful about when you make the finding. Just don't look for a while.
Just make sure you're sure.
Yeah. Within that, it basically what you're required to have in that statement is the recommended actions and a contribution rate or range. But essentially, that you have to actually come up with recommendations. Now, what that might do is it precludes the opportunity to maybe do too much discussion and relationship with the employer about this. But it's basically got 15 days to get that out. The restoration plan, the licensee or the trustee is responsible for doing that. They have to do that within 3 months of receiving your statement, and a copy has to be given to APRA within 15 days of them setting out that restoration plan. So a couple of the other issues that aren't on the slide there is that that you have to consider the likelihood that the employer will pay those extra contributions, yet you've got 15 days to come up with the recommendations. But what they've done as part of this restoration plan is they've clearly placed the onus on the trustee to engage and consult with the employer. So it's almost an assumption that that's not so much the actuarial role, it's the trustee role to consult with the employer. If you actually fall below the shortfall limit, you actually go under actuarial management. So if you breach the shortfall limit, the actuary is involved and basically has to recommend any reduction in benefits. And so it doesn't say what happens if the employer isn't paying the extra contributions that are mandated, but you connect all the dots and it looks like that the trustee consults with the employer. If the employer decides not to pay the contributions within the range or within the recommendations that the actuary has made, then maybe potentially once you have breached the threshold, you go to the actuary who has to then reduce benefits. Yes. Vested benefits. This is a shortfall based on vested benefits from the previous slide, absolutely. Yep. Thanks, Matthew. Exactly right. In some funds there might be, but in others there won't be. But it's making a recommendation. So then it's up to the trustee to then work with the regulator in other areas about what you then do. I'm running out of time, I think. I've got insurance also to cover. A couple of things that came out in insurance. Obviously, if you're self-insuring, you must maintain reserves. You must attest annually that it's in members' best interests to continue self-insuring. You have to have actuarial control at least every 3 years, and you also have to have a contingency plan for the orderly wind-up of any self-insurance benefits, so that just in case you ever decide that you're not going to self-insure anymore, you have to have a plan in advance about how you'll manage that process. A couple of other things on insurance. There's a separate SPS 250 on insurance. The main things from this are that you have to have policies on a whole lot of things. You have to have a policy about your premiums that will charge members, how you manage underwriting, how you manage claims. You have to have a process for reviewing decisions so that if a member has declined insurance or has any restrictions placed on the cover, you have to have a defined review process where they can complain about that and then how you review their complaints. You also have to have, there are rules in there about how you monitor insurance relationships, so you have to have actually a process for renewing your insurance each year, and you also have to have regular contact with the insurer at senior levels or at appropriate levels, and you also have to monitor service levels, so that includes claims management and other areas, so that you actually can't just sort of say, well, the insurer is still looking at that. You have to have service levels at which you measure the competence of your insurer to make sure they're meeting the levels that you want them to meet for your members. And essentially, you have to demonstrate that your insurance process is appropriate.
Okay. Last Late last year, we issued a draft, the Institute issued a draft practice guideline on financial condition reports for super funds, and it sort of covered the main, financial condition report covers those main areas. And we think that financial condition reports will play a useful role, can play a useful role in helping boards meet their obligations under the prudential standards. Certainly, we think the financial strength assessment is good for the operational risk part. The fund sustainability, where we project the fund forward, we think is good for the replenishment of the op risk reserves, but also the scale assessment under the SIS Act. We think that the risk review and the stress testing are very, very useful, and indeed the stress testing's actually been called out in the professional, the prudential standards. Now, we've been very careful not to, as an institute, not to call for a monopoly, not to call for a mandate to do this. And instead, we've met with all stakeholders in the industry, including APRA, and suggested that it would be it's an example of good practice. And certainly we had a very constructive meeting with APRA a few weeks ago, where we met with different people through the organisation, and it was clear there was a lot of interest in this. So certainly we think that we hope to have a further meeting with APRA in Melbourne for the people in Melbourne. The Institute has... we've responded to the consultation... we'll respond to the consultation on the draft standards, and that's due, I think, at the end of July or mid-July. The SCBPC is going to be considering the revised practice guideline on the 4th of May, and the June Council meeting will hopefully approve that FCR guideline, subject to any changes. But certainly after that, we're going to be undertaking more liaison and promotion of the fact that we have this FCR guideline and it can be used for the prudential standards. Look, I'm very sorry. This is in a very condensed session. There's a lot to get through in 40 minutes. But certainly, if there's any questions or comments before lunch.
Yeah, we've certainly got the big ticket items have been sort of put up there today. So any sort of closing comments or questions, Tony?
Just in terms of establishing this operational reserve and the ongoing maintenance, is it anticipated that employers will pay additional to create and maintain them, or it will come out of the ESG contributions and hence reduce member allocations?
My speculation is that it'll come out of investment returns in the mutual fund, in the industry funds. For the retail funds and the master trusts, that'll be it's a very interesting point. Will the funds, say AMP, use their capital that they already have to meet that requirement and then have a bit of a competitive advantage compared to other funds? That's an interesting point.
Just a comment that on the 17th of May, the Institute and APRA are holding a session on this mandatory system. You might have to you should do it.
And I think we have a presenter possibly on the...
Yeah, I think I'll be heading
on. Well, I'll be one of the panels that day.
Everyone for coming along. There are actually one thing that Darren did say though was that they're all very readable. The longest one is about 11 pages. So if any particular topic takes your fancy, it only takes you 10 or 15 minutes of time to actually read each one. And if you have any comments or feedback you want to push through to us, please let us know. The responses are due by mid-July, so you've got a bit of time to read them. Thanks for coming along.